34, I believe. And Genesis chapter 34, this is, for those of you who read it before or read it prior to this class, it's really, it's bad, you know, the things that happen. There's nothing good about this chapter. We have some sexual immorality that takes place. We have a lot of killing that takes place as a result of that, and so there's a lot of bloodshed in this chapter, a lot of violence, and so it's certainly not a fun or real enjoyable text to go through because of the violence. But I think there's many reasons for it, and I'm sure that I'm not going to be able to provide answers for everything or give all the reasons for the chapter or the things that go on here. But it's definitely a significant event, and it is it's recorded here for the purpose of its significance. Of its significance as a standalone event, but also as its significance in the span of the time and the history and the growth of this man Jacob and his maturity. And I think that has a lot to do with what happens here in the text. So, first things first, we might be able to say that all of this could have been avoided. And, you know, when Jacob is considered a man of faith, he's considered a man of faith when he dwells in tents, like, you know, Abraham did and his father Isaac did. They were considered men of faith when they did not place themselves in situations among the peoples and within the cities. But that's what Jacob seems to do here, and so this is one of the more failing moments and poor decisions of Jacob in his life. And you know, when God, why has he come to this area? Well, again, if you look back at chapter 33, beginning in verse 18, remember that he had just broke off with his brother Esau. He told Esau, "I'll go on to Edom, you know, and I'll see you soon." And then it doesn't show in the text that he ever sees his brother again in Edom. Now, I do believe he does. But in verse 18, it says, "Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. And he came near Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought the parcel of land which he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohi Israel." And in this situation, of course, you can say, "Well, you know, Jake, he's still pitching a tent after all." Well, yeah, okay, so he's not exactly a part of these individuals, but, you know, he's pushing the line. He's as close as you can get. You know, he's on their land, so much so that he purchases the piece of land. So, you know, he's butted up there, right there with them, and that's not something that we usually see with like, you know, Father Abraham, It's not something we always see with Jacob as well. But at this point, in this moment, for some reason, he has chosen to make this place his home, and he's going to be here for some time. We know that because in chapter 34, we have Dinah, his daughter, and she's of marrying age. Well, this would roughly, I mean, this is going to have to be a rough estimation, but the scholars believe that this would put the, you know, chapter 33 and chapter 34 about, you know, six or seven years apart from each other, in order to give time for the further growth of Dinah to reach some sort of marrying age. So there is definitely time going through here that a number of years that just are not recorded. No significant event is pointed out within those years in these histories. So, and that's why I mentioned earlier that although in the text it doesn't show Jacob visiting Esau in Edom like he said he was going to do, but the text clearly is not pointing out every detail and everything that Jacob is doing. There's other things that we'll find later in the text where we'll realize that Jacob has been doing some visiting, probably with Esau in Edom. He seems to have been doing some visiting with his father. Wait a second, Isaac's still alive? I mean, you know, this is why Jacob left, you know, because his father was near death and Esau was going to kill Jacob, right after his father died. Well, you know, here he comes back so many years later, and his father is still alive, and he's clearly done some visiting with his father. That's evident because at some point they pick up in their traveling, his mother, Rebecca, they pick up her maid, so she ends up passing away with them, but... So it's clear that not everything is here. Only points of significance, only things that matter, only things that alter the course of life and history, only things that matter in terms of spiritual growth and maturity and the error of a way and the correction of that error. We see that God, you know, recording many things with Abraham that he shouldn't have been doing, shouldn't have gotten involved in, shouldn't have said that, shouldn't have done that. And God records those things for us. And we were able to, more so than Isaac or Jacob, we were able to witness very closely the gradual progression of Abraham's maturity and faith. It was really... really astounding. But so what we find here, I say all of this to try to put us in the right frame of mind when we come to chapter 38, and we might get caught up in all the violence and all the gross things, but the reality is this is an event that happens that it likely, as I said, probably didn't need to happen. Jacob seems to stop short. You know, he doesn't go all the way in terms of what I think he should have done and what the text seems to suggest he should have done. When God called him to come back, remember he said, come, first of all, God says, I am the God of Bethel. And then he tells him to come back in chapter 31. I believe it's verse 13-ish or 8 or 13, somewhere around there. But I am the God of Bethel. You come back to your family in the land of Canaan. And Jacob appears, now I could be wrong with my estimation of this text, but reading through here, it appears that he stopped short. He definitely stopped short of Bethel. He doesn't get there. Now, whether he visited it or not, again, we could argue that about that all day, and nobody could come up with the right answer because it's not he stops short of Bethel. He stops short of his father's house. He stops short of his family. And he lands here in this place, the city of Shechem. And so, you know, who's he been dealing with? He's been dealing with the God of Bethel. Why didn't he go to Bethel? When God told him to go to your family, why didn't he go to his family? Instead, he goes to Shechem. And so the way I see that, again, I could be wrong. The way I see it is that Jacob has made a bit of an error here in his life. And he has not fully, you know, taken the steps that I think was pretty well drawn out by what God was saying to him when God called him to come back. So here he is in Padan Aram, and in this city of Shechem, and he remains there for, as it appears, many years. 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. It could be 10 years even. But he's there for some time, clearly. And his daughter grows up around these areas, and now she's coming of age in chapter 34, and something terrible befalls her, and more terrible things happen as a result of the terrible thing that happens to her. But the thing is, as I said, all of this could have been avoided if he had just paid close attention to I think what God was pointing him to do, and it does not appear that he did it. And I'm trying to be careful with my language there, because I certainly don't want to sound dogmatic about this, because as I said, there's a lot. As the text jumps, you know, through the years. So but that is the sense that I'm getting anyway from the text and from the language and from what God had told him to do, and it just does not appear that he did what God called him back to do. And then when all the terrible things happen, after it's all said and done, notice in chapter 35, the next chapter, chapter 35 and verse 1, notice it says, "Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there." You know, I find that interesting. So, here, big mistakes have happened. Big problem. Huge. And now, God is once again coming to speak to him. And evidently, maybe he hasn't... God hasn't spoke to him in all these years, in all this time that he's chosen to live at Shechem. Now, after all this terrible situation, God once again talks to him and says, come to Bethel. You know, it's really where he ought to have come, you know, at the first. Because remember, also what Jacob had said, remember, Bethel, that was the place for Jacob. That's where he saw the ladder. That's where he dreamed the dream. He's the one who named the place Bethel. He knows the place. He named it. And so, what did he say was, there when he was at Bethel so many years ago, you know, he talked about how he would come back if God would be with him and bless him. The idea is, you know, that he would be coming back. And so... when God appeared to him finally so many years later and says, "I'm the God of Bethel, now come back to your family," and Jacob starts in, and as I said, it appears that he stops short, and because of that we have a lot of folly that takes place, and then God coming back to him, you see to me, God always did this with Abraham as well. Abraham wouldn't do what God would want him to do. And he got himself in a heap of mess. And then God will come back to him and pretty straightforwardly just tell him what he needs to do again. You know, and there's not this, there isn't this big, you know, wagging the finger and, you know, I told you, and all this, I told you so, or anything like that. There's just, all right, now do what I told you to do, you know, or have faith in me like I told you have faith in me, you know, something like that. See that all through the scriptures. Jonah, the book of Jonah is like that, right? God told him to go to Nineveh. He doesn't do it. Heap of mess. Big, big issue. You know, and then after it's all over and he's sped out by that great fish, God appears, you know, speaks to him again, and he says, go to Nineveh. It's just, you know, it just, we skipped the whole I told you so. It's pretty evident. But at any rate, so let's go ahead and read through the text and see the problems that befall them here in Shechem. So, chapter 34 in Genesis, verse 1. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, and Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, give me this young woman as a wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved and were very angry because he had done the disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife. And make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it. Well, let's pause here for a moment. You see what's happening. As Jacob has placed his family in this situation, very close proximity to these people, you know, we call them the people who don't know God, you know, and they don't serve God in any means. But he has placed his family here, and notice what is progressing now is this thought of marrying, and here is, you know, something that was always against Abraham and Isaac, and now Jacob is being tempted here to do what Abraham never would have had done, and that is that intermarrying with these foreigners that were around them, but here's the temptation: is number one, Jacob surely he has great relations, you know, with these people. He's been with them for a number of years now. He's purchased land from them. They have business relationship there in some form. And now here's the temptation where we could all be made one. You know, a union can be struck in the form of marriage by which we can work and trade and increase wealth with the greater numbers that we have. And so this is quite a temptation for Jacob, who already at this point in his life is really not exactly as it seems where he ought to be in life, but this is where he's put himself, and here are the problems that are coming, and here are the temptations that are coming. So what we have here is an offer made to Jacob that sounds very against the ideas of Father Abraham. So if we keep reading in the text, in verse 11, it says, "Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, 'Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me. But give me the young woman as a wife.' But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you, if you will become as we are. If every male of you is circumcised, then we will give you give our daughters to you, and you will take we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone.'" So here we have a demand made, not by Jacob, but made by Jacob's sons, who also know, they all know about the situation that happened with Dinah, though it seems possibly that Shechem and Hamor don't know that they know. Nonetheless, what we have here is Jacob's sons speaking deceitfully. That's what verse 13 tells us. And it tells us that before it tells us what they have in mind here, or what the plan is. So what they're saying is deceitful. We don't know why as of yet. We'll have to keep reading the text to realize what is deceitful about this. But when I find this word deceitful in the text, it makes me chuckle a little bit, because here are Jacob's sons speaking deceitfully, and you know they come by it honestly, you know, I guess, so to speak, in the sense that their father, you know, Jacob, this is him, this is his calling card. He is the supplanter. He is the one who is deceitful, and he tricks, and he tricks people and causes them to stumble, and he takes their place instead. And he has done this time after time after time throughout his life. And then we ran into other members of the family older than him that seem to have those kinds of attributes as well, like Laban had. And so here now are his sons, and they are tricking. They are causing someone else to stumble. You know, this is like what their father has always done. So they say, "You all need to be circumcised. And if you are, we'll be one people." You know, we look at that word. That's a very dangerous statement right there in terms of everything we've read thus far in the book of Genesis, because Abraham's family is not to be one with anybody else, you know, not with any foreign land, foreign country, or anything like that. This word is very dangerous. Of course, they're speaking deceitfully, so they have no plan whatsoever to be one people with the people of Shechem. So notice what happens here. Verse 18 says, "And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father." Pause there for a second. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? He was more honorable than all the household of his father. That's kind of scary. He's the lesser of quite a problem. And as it appears, you know, he's had, unless they give Dinah to him, but they wouldn't have until they, you know, the circumcision had taken place. And but you notice that Dinah is in his house already. And so, you know, it appears that she's been there. You know, she's been kept there or what have you. There's been nothing honorable about this. And so, you know, for the text to say that he was more honorable than everybody else, you know, just goes to show how immoral this people were. So verse 20, "And Hamor and Shechem his son came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, 'These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us.' And all who went out of the gate of his city, heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. So they're seeing this as a really good business deal, and they can acquire a lot from this transaction. So it's you know, as simple as a small surgery that you know, take a little bit of time to recover, but you know, it's not a very life-threatening procedure by any means, not so much, and so they have so much to gain. You know, there's so many women to gain, you know, property, possessions, herds, all of that, if they become one people with the family of Jacob. Remember, Jacob's quite wealthy. He's very wealthy. God had blessed him significantly in his time working with Laban. So, in verse 25, we haven't gotten to the deceitful stuff yet. So verse 25, it says, "Now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain." All right, they'd all been circumcised. So on the third day of their circumcision, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I.' But they said, 'Should he treat our sister like a harlot?'" All right, so we see what happens. Everybody's in bed rest, you know, because of their procedures. And here are just two of the sons of Levi, Simeon and Levi, grab their swords up. They come, they easily take the city. They kill all the males. And they literally take everything else from the city into their possession and take captives of the city. So Jacob's response to this is interesting. You know, Jacob, you know, he was there during the discussions, you know, as far as what would happen. And he clearly heard what his sons had offered. So I don't know what was on his mind, what he thought was going on, or what he thought was going to happen. But now that it's happened, it's fully unfolded here. He's upset. He says, "I'm troubled." He's more than upset. He thinks he's a goner. This event, warfare, basically, would cause all the surrounding peoples to look upon Jacob and see him as one who came up, pitched his tent, and now has committed great warfare. And so this is going to become, in his mind, it's going to become a serious problem for him. And so what does he think? He thinks the Canaanites and the Perizzites are going to gather up against them in retaliation and kill Jacob and kill his household as well. Of course, his sons, their response was, should we have just allowed this? Allowed him to treat our sister like a harlot? So their idea was, this had to happen. This had to be the case. This had to be the result. So a lot of issues here. Of course, we see, as I said, possibly none of this needed to even happen. If Jacob had placed himself in a wiser location, maybe back with near Isaac or something like that. Also, what do we find? But we find a shook up Jacob here, and this has been. This has been his failure throughout his life, is getting concerned about what man is going to do. Whether he was concerned about what Esau was going to do, or concerned about this or that, he struggled with that. And here he is falling back into that again. So these years in Shechem, these moments, not the finest moments for Jacob, not the finest moments for his faith. He's back to being on that shaky ground of being worried about what men would do to him. So he's been worried many times about death, about being killed by other people. And this is something that God had continually dealt with him and talked to him about. But we see him falling back into it. So that's chapter 34. And then God speaks in chapter 35. And what God does, he's right back on track. God says to Jacob, arise, get up. Go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And so God reminds him to go to Bethel. Reminds him, like he did before all this event, is, I'm the God of Bethel. And I'm the God that you saw in that place that you named Bethel, which means house of God. And he says, go there and dwell there and make an altar. And what we have here is a reigniting in Jacob, and I don't really use these terms, but very much so a spiritual awakening, I guess you could say, as he's, Bethel, that's where I was journeying to until I saw this really cool place and thought I'd live here instead. And notice what, so notice what he happens in this revival of himself. In verse 2, it says, "And Jacob said to his household, to all who are with him, put away the foreign gods from that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel." It's like, what's going on? You know, they've got other gods. You know, he's got idolatry in his family. They've picked up these other gods from their old homeland, maybe from Shechem. It's crazy. And so now God says, go over to Bethel and dwell there. And Jacob's like, I remember, you know. And he turns to his family and says, we got to get rid of these. We got to serve God. We got to get rid of these idols. Let's put them away from us and let's go to Bethel and let's worship God. So, pretty crazy. Anyway.
I got one question, and I know you said you wouldn't be able to answer this. I'm just curious. When Hagar and Shechem met with the family, it appeared the sons were unanimous in the decision to do what they did. Jacob had no part in it. Any idea why?
I don't know. I mean, as I said, I think he was there.
Because that's one of the things of the birthright that he should have, you know, was given. He was in charge of the family.
Yeah.
And that's one decision he didn't make.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah, that's a difficult one. All right, we're out of time, so we'll pick up there in verse 35.